Good morning. Good to be back with you. And for those of you who might have been at some of my previous sessions here on church history, this will be a distinct change of pace, I think. For a start, there won't be somewhere between 28 and 32 overhead slides. And I'll probably speak a little bit slower, for which... No, that's it. That's the downside. Sorry. Okay. Because let's face it, if I ask you questions about my story, you know, you might be unfair, mightn't it? Okay. So, format this morning, I'm planning to speak for probably about 15 minutes or so, and then show a four-minute DVD at the end of that. So a little bit about where things started for me, and I guess my prayer is here that what will happen today won't just be me prattling on about me, but that in fact there'll be things here that will resonate with you and your journey, things that you'll find relevant. I was born into a family that was fifth generation in a church called the Reorganized Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. So many of you would have heard of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, and you'd know that that's the Mormon Church. So the Reorganized is really a subgroup of that, and my great-great-grandmother was converted into Mormonism back when Joseph Smith, the founder of Mormonism, was alive. So, you know, on one of, I think, the first mission to England around about 1840. So Mormonism was really part of my DNA for those five generations. I grew up in that family and at that church, and it really was church and family, literally. Most of the people who went to the church I was related to. It's a much smaller group than the mainstream Mormon church, probably only about 200,000, 250,000 members worldwide compared to the several million that I think is the figure for the mainstream Mormon church. There were some key differences between the Reorganized Church and the mainstream Mormons, but some of you might know too much about the mainstream Mormons to start with, so just I'll speak very quickly on that. And just before I do, you probably never have heard of the Reorganized Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. There are only two branches here in Western Australia, really. And it's made harder to spot by the fact that in recent years they changed their name to the Community of Christ, from which you really wouldn't spot the origins there. So very, very briefly, the mainstream Mormon teaching is that the church had gone into apostasy, that the Reformation under Martin Luther and others of the 16th century wasn't enough, and that what was really needed was a restoration, not a reformation. And they felt that that happened under a guy called Joseph Smith around about 1830 in New York State, when, depending on which version of this first vision you look at, either one or all three members of the Trinity simultaneously appeared to Joseph Smith in a grove in upstate New York, told him that all the other churches were an abomination and that he should essentially start his own. Sometime later there were angelic revelations about some golden plates which were supposed to be the records of ancient inhabitants of the Americas. Those golden plates, which were supposed to have been written in Reformed Egyptian, were eventually delivered to Joseph Smith. He translated the Book of Mormon from those golden plates. Subsequently, the golden plates disappeared back to heaven, courtesy of Angel Courier, and the Book of Mormon was published. Now, the Book of Mormon was put forward as an additional witness to the Bible. Subsequent to that, there was also another book called The Doctrine and Covenants, which, because they saw Joseph Smith as a prophet with an ongoing access to God, every now and then there would be ongoing revelations. So The Doctrine and Covenants was an open-ended book. I don't know how many revelations are in there now, but it's well over 150. Where my group came in was that they disagreed with some of the things that had happened in the latter years of Joseph Smith's life, and particularly things like some of the more controversial doctrines of Mormonism, which you may have heard of, such as polygamy and plurality of gods. So the idea was that if you were a male Mormon in good standing, which would mean that you were in the priesthood, what would happen to you after you died? You would be exalted and you would be as a god ruling and reigning over your own planet. And what would happen if you were a woman? Well, you couldn't get into the priesthood being a woman. What you could do, though, very conveniently, is be married to somebody who was a god ruling and reigning over his own planet and have children in perpetuity to populate that planet. But of course, one woman is going to take an awful long time to populate a planet. So it's much more efficient to have many wives and you populate the planet faster. And so the polygamy idea came in. Now, initially this was seen as celestial marriage. In other words, it's something that we don't really do on Earth. We marry to other people for heaven to populate our planets. But in practice it blurred and it came into an earthly practice as well, which, you know, created some issues. Now, the group that I belong to felt that polygamy was wrong, and they felt that plurality of gods was wrong. They also argued that Joseph hadn't actually taught those before he died in 1844. So in one way we were a bit more normal. In other ways we weren't, because we had our own translation of the Bible. The mainstream Mormons stuck to the King James Version, still do. We had what was called the Inspired Version, implying, of course, that none of the other versions were. And the idea was that those very same churches that had been so apostatizing during the Middle Ages, not casting any fingers anyway, were obviously, they mismanaged the transmission of the biblical text. Things were miscopied, etc., etc. So really what we needed was another hotwire translation. So the Inspired Version was Joseph's attempt to restore things to the Bible that had been taken out of it, or perhaps to take things out of the Bible he didn't think should be there. So they were the key distinctions between the two groups. Now, I grew up in this group thinking that this was right. Everybody I knew believed in this, and I thought that this must be the way to go. This must be true. But I also knew two things. One was that I didn't want to accept just a second-hand faith, or perhaps in my case, a fifth-hand faith through five generations. I wanted to have a test in me. I wanted to know that something was true for myself, not just have it handed down. The other thing I realised was that in this particular group, what happens to you when you're... Is anyone here about late teens? You're girls, sorry. Has to happen to guys, right? You're safe. If you're a guy and you're in your late teens, you could get a tap on the shoulder one day. And that would be the pastor of your church saying to you, I think God is calling you to the office of dot, dot, dot. Could be priest or deacon or teacher or elder. And they would ask you to pray about that and to hopefully accept that particular calling. You could refuse it. But I was seeing some people who were younger than me getting that tap on the shoulder. And I was thinking, probably the only reason that I'm not getting the tap on the shoulder is that my stepfather is the pastor of the church. He has some idea of some of the discrepancies in my life, in my late teens. And that's buying me some time. But it's not going to buy me a lot of time. And one day this tap on the shoulder is going to come and I'm going to be put in the spot of accepting or rejecting this. I knew I wasn't ready to do that. So I was looking for a bit of an out. That out came for me in August 1977, the day after Elvis Presley died. And a close friend of mine came around and with some news to tell me. And he said, look, I've been going out with Sue for 6 years. She's just dumped me. I thought we were going to get married. I've been saving up money. I had an engagement ring. It's obviously not going to happen. My reaction is I'm going to travel the world for as long as my money lasts. Do you want to come? About 2 minutes later, I'd answered yes. And a third guy joined us who was the other guy's future brother-in-law if he'd married that same girl. Anyway, so we headed overseas. This gave me my out. I was gone for 20 months. We travelled through about 30 countries. Went up through Southeast Asia to Kathmandu, got on a bus in Kathmandu and got off in London. This was 1978. 2.5 month bus trip with the same 30 people. You got to know them fairly well by the end. And it was when you could go through places like Iraq and Iran and Afghanistan and get out alive. 20 months later, okay, during that time, I'd got to visit the United States. I still had this thing, I've got to check this out for myself. The headquarters of the church I grew up in, as opposed to Utah, which is the headquarters of the Mormon church, was in a place called Independence, Missouri, which is not far from Kansas City. I made a beeline for the archives there, ferreted myself away into the 19th century, photocopied all this stuff that was simply not available in Australia. We're talking long before the internet, okay? So sources were harder to obtain. And eventually, in late 1979, came home. And I started pouring through this material, moved back into my mum and stepdad's place, and eventually realised I actually can't believe this stuff because of the sort of things I'm finding out. So I'd gone from high school to do an arts degree. I initially thought I was going to be a journalist until I discovered one or two of them who were my lecturers were fairly eccentric and did things like nailing doors into door jams to stop students that they didn't like getting into the classroom. And I decided I didn't want to be like that in my mid-40s, so I just ditched that. But I still liked the idea of writing. So I thought, I've got a responsibility to tell these people I've grown up with what I've discovered. I only discovered it by going to America. They're not going to go to America. They're not going to find this stuff. So I wrote a book with a very positive title called Reasons for Disbelief. My mother, who had been the church organist for 32 years and had taught at Fremantle Technical College. Anyone remembers Gestetner machines? Whoa, okay. For those of you under my age, they were the predecessors of photocopiers. Okay, quite messy and manual and sort of carbon something or other. We ran off a massive edition of 24 copies of this book on the Fremantle Tech Gestetner. And I busily handed them out and, you know, didn't know what people would do. One of the things that... I should just backtrack one step there before we got to the printing off the book. This was, I guess, first time I had what you could call a really miraculous answer to prayer. I'd come back from overseas, I was in my parents' house, I was spreading all these hundreds of papers around and making a real mess with my research. And my parents were fairly tidy. And I realised this was causing them a little bit of angst. And I prayed a really ridiculous prayer at the time. And it went something like this. Dear God, I'd really like a place of my own, but I don't want to share, I don't want to pay rent, and I don't want a mortgage. Now, I don't know if you ever felt painted into a corner, but, you know, that sort of paints God into a corner. I had no expectation that a prayer like that would be answered. 6 weeks later, it was. My parents had split up when I was 5, and my father worked in public service jobs. He wasn't a wealthy man. He rang my mother up and said, "Do you think Peter would mind if I bought him a home unit?" And she said, "No, I don't think he'd mind at all." Now, putting this in scale, this is $40,000 in 1980, still quite a lot of money, right? My father's logic at the time was he thought he might remarry, and the woman he might remarry would have kids he'd have to take on a responsibility for. And so this was his way of leaving me an inheritance. Why did it come at that time? When he wasn't even going out with anyone. Okay? When he had previously gone out with other people and it hadn't happened. Suddenly, I was in a townhouse in Fremantle that was mine, and I realised, oh, I've got to make good on this deal. So I wrote the book in 6 weeks, right? Around a full-time job. So I was burning the midnight oil. So the book comes out. My mother did something that then was very annoying. Because what I uncovered was a lot of historical stuff that I knew the leadership of the churches knew, but they weren't making it public. She, without my permission, sends a copy of my book to the first presidency of the church in America with a please explain letter. Okay. Now, that led to a long correspondence. I was, you know, in a correspondence with a guy called Richard Howard, who was the official church historian. You know, he was a PhD in history. I had a BA in English literature from people who used to nail door jams into doors into door jams. It wasn't really an equal fight. But in the end, in one of those letters, they said that the church wasn't making this stuff public because they had a long-range plan to change people's thinking. And at that point, I realised, here's my resignation. I'm out of here. I was left with a basic faith in God, but obviously I'd left my childhood faith behind. The next thing that happened was gold prospecting. The same two guys that I'd travelled with, we were all getting itchy feet, we were all in jobs, we were saving money, travel was beckoning, and we thought, let's go gold prospecting. So we bought a cheap second-hand Land Rover in 1981, appropriately enough, headed out on April Fool's Day that year, around Laverton, Leonora. We were only out for about 6 weeks. Amazingly, we found 19 pieces of gold. Nowhere near enough to pay for the Land Rover, I might admit. About $1,000 worth of gold in the prices at the time. But while we were out there, we were talking about travel, and we were reading books by a guy called John Hillaby, who was a long-distance walker. And I foolishly, you know, it gets hot out on the goldfields in Western Australia, even around April, May. And I said, look, I'm going to walk from Athens to London. And my friend Derek, who is was a cartographer by trade, did a quick mental calculation, said, don't be stupid, that's about 3,000 miles. And I said, well, all right then, I'm going to walk around Ireland. 3 weeks later, I'm on a plane. You know, I'd said it, I had to do it. Was there any money involved in this bet? No. Should I have been sponsored by Guinness? But yes, but was I? No. So I spent the next 3 months walking around Ireland, as in not hitchhiking, just walking. Landing in the southeast in Rosslare, going around up the west, briefly into the north and back down. Had to refuse a lot of lifts because the Irish are very hospitable people, as you know. Now, but I used that time to read the New Testament through because I thought that seemed like a sensible thing to do. The other two things that I was doing in that trip was going to Israel and Egypt, which explains why when I went to the airport in June 1981, my mother turned up totally in black because she thought she was never going to see me again. Israel, Egypt and Ireland, at the time, three of the world's trouble spots. The land opening, the Camp David talks had happened not long before. You could travel by land from Israel to Egypt and back again. And to cut the story short a little bit, when I was travelling around Israel, I met a number of people for whom Christianity was a living faith, for whom Jesus was real. I met a Jewish guy who had converted 8 months before, and his whole Jewish background had suddenly been transmuted into a Christian faith. A casual conversation in a Christian hostel becomes a sermon. And I started to realise people's lives were changed by their faith. It wasn't just something that was a club. It wasn't just something you turned up to on Sundays. And that was something I hadn't really seen before. And there's a place in Jerusalem, you know, I'd read the New Testament, I'd seen this change in people's lives. There's a place in Jerusalem called the Garden Tomb. And some of you may have seen pictures of it. I went there a few times because it was free, it was peaceful. And there's a picture of it on the DVD we'll look at in a minute. And one day I was there and I was sitting in front of the empty tomb. Now, it's a first century tomb. It could have been the tomb of Christ. Nobody's actually sure. Key thing is it is empty. And they've got this very good garden around it. And there were three worship services going on either side and behind me. There's a group of Japanese, a group of Germans, and a group of black Americans. Different languages. In front of me, I remember getting really, really annoyed because in front, and I do have to say, I believe they were American tourists, but in the tomb, I didn't even go into the tomb. I just sat and looked at it. But people were going in and taking flash photographs and, you know, thinking, why would you do that? But anyway, here I am, sitting in front of an empty tomb with pyrotechnics going off, courtesy of American flashbulbs inside it, and three worship services going around. And at that moment, I realised God actually has a sense of humour. He's brought me through 30 countries out of something that I now believe was completely wrong, plonked me in a garden, reenacts the day of Pentecost in worship services around me, and has people setting off flashbulbs in a tomb. And I thought, if I don't get it now, I am really thick. And I said, okay, I get it, I surrender, I'm yours. And that was the change at moment for me. Came back home. Because of the historical bent to my mind, I started reading books like Evidence That Demands a Verdict and Who Moved the Stone, and books like that, that convinced me that Christianity was right. A couple of years later, went to Bible college. I'd met Deborah before that, but we started going out in Bible college. I was a bit shocked when I realised that she was still in high school just before that. Moved rapidly, married her while she was still 19. I was 28. So, you know, if you see something good, you have to make a move. And the Bible college we went to was what used to be called Rhema Bible College. And I ended up on staff there for about 3 years. We ended up leaving because of really theological differences. But during that time, I knew a couple of things. I knew I wanted to be involved in Bible colleges, and I knew I wanted to be involved in church history at Bible colleges. So I knew there'd be further theological study for me down the track. Didn't know when. 1992 was a fairly key year for us. I got asked to go to Sabah and write the life story of a missionary there, a guy called Trevor White. So that was a time we spent a fortnight there. I had a borrowed laptop computer, which nearly died due to faulty electricity supplies up in the jungles of Sabah. Deborah took to the fields with the ladies and developed skills in rice harvesting and coconut dodging, which she hasn't used much lately, I must admit. And it was also a year where we discovered a major challenge, that we had an infertility challenge. The problem physically was mine. It didn't look like we'd ever be able to have any children. And we initially looked at IVF at that stage, 92, and the first specialist we saw said, "It's not going to work, don't put your wife through it, adopt." That was a fairly earth-shattering moment for us. I remember thinking in that specialist's office, I thought, well, we can either accept this or we can go down another path. And at that point, you hear a lot about open and closed doors. And at that point, I fine-tuned my theology a little bit. Some doors are open, some doors are closed. Some doors are closed and need to be kicked down. And we got another referral, and there's been a different outcome to that, as you'll soon see. 94 to 96, did some theological study at the Baptist Theological College, as it was then. And during that time, technology caught up with us. We went through IVF, and Joel was born. As soon as I finished that degree, started lecturing in Bible colleges in 97. Been doing that ever since. Was on staff at Riverview for about 10 years, lecturing at their college. In the late 80s, I'd started doing some work in the fundraising area. I'd fallen into that industry. And really, since 1989 onwards, I've been blending the two, Bible colleges and fundraising. And my main job at the moment is in fundraising. In 1999, Jason was born. I did a master's degree part-time, and then in 2007 started my PhD. I sort of made a decision that I'd only do the PhD if I got a scholarship. Otherwise, I'd look at it as a retirement activity. Got the scholarship, did the PhD, and that's been published a few months ago. One of the interesting things is, at the moment, I'm not working in a job that really is my passion. My main job at Murdoch University, hopefully no one at Murdoch University will be listening to this recording later on, is something that is in the fundraising zone. It's something that I can do and get paid for, but I still only lecture part-time at Bible colleges. So, and that's where my real passion is. So, that's an ongoing tension, something that is there in my life. Now, what I might do now is just quickly play this DVD. It goes for about 4 minutes. I guess the sound will probably work as well as the vision when we do it. Okay. And this will pick up anything that I've missed out. Now, I have to warn you that this was recorded 10 years ago. So you're about to suddenly go back in time and see a 10-year-younger version of me. So prepare yourself for a bit of a shock.
Where's your headphone out?
It's on the phone.
No? I can't see you.
Oh, I can't see them.
Someone with glasses?
I've got glasses, I can't even see. Okay. Just a suit of your hat. Oh, it could be.
Oh, here we go. It's one of these. It is. Got Try it. That one.
Okay, excellent. Here we go. Okay, can I just stand here?
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. I just want to check survival.
Oh, unblank this.
Oh, yeah. Okay,
sorry. Okay. Oh, it's you. Just turn the sound up.
Yep.
Okay.
Is that right.
It might be the other hole.
It didn't do anything, did it? I just pushed play.
It's not playing then?
No. No, it's not. There should be noise.
Play the one.
No.
It's about up here.
Okay.
Is But he hasn't got any. Oh, it's.
Yeah. Maybe I can just. Maybe this will be loud enough, do you reckon? Or not?
So that's not playing already. So no. just get it working without this plugged in.
Yep.
See if you can do that.
Yeah.
That's not going to help.
It's working at home.
There's no sound coming out at all. Out of this one as well.
That's right.
Yeah, but okay. If you're unplugged, is it doesn't still come out the speakers.
Okay.
Is it the HDMI thing?
Could be. Put it in again. Doesn't work, I'll just kick off again. It'll come up automatically now.
Yeah. You just don't. That's
the
right.
Sound?
Why have you not got any sound? Hang on, let's just slow this down.
Yep. Down there.
Now, where's your speaker?
Yep. So I've unmuted that.
Why isn't that coming up? Hang on. Let's do it again. That's not it.
No.
That's not working. Oh.
Okay.
Let's try it again.
No.
Let's try this one again.
All right. Might just have to give it a miss if we can do it.
I suspect that's the right one. Is that plugged in?
Might give it a miss. Sorry? Is it? Now? Paul, they're just saying the guys are over there saying it is coming through the speakers.
Why is it not coming through?
Can we try it on this DVD player?
No.
We've got something coming out of the speakers. Why don't we just use it?
Just go with that. Use that.
Yep.
Standing one. If I got the
thing. Okay.
Oh, okay. That
this
one. Apparently.
Nope. Okay, rest it there. Okay. Okay. Sorry. Okay. Ready? Nothing coming out. Okay. I might just give it a miss. No. Okay. All right. Now I need this back here, don't I? All right. Apologies for the technical difficulties. Okay. Well, yep. Now you can see how much I've aged in 10 years. Sorry about that.
You look younger now.
Really?
Yeah.
How's your prescription?
Thank you, glasses.
Excellent. Brand new.
Okay. All right. What I was going to do after this 4-minute video that sadly hasn't happened was just reflect on a couple of things that have come to me looking at my journey. One is the importance of history in a couple of ways. You've seen me here for 4 weeks previously talking about church history. Obviously, that's corporate history that affects all of us.
Can we have it louder, please?
He's not talking about the mic.
Okay, sorry. A bit better? Sorry, wandered off the mic. Okay, so you've heard me talk on the importance of corporate church history, but history was really what set me free from the reorganized church and the offshoot of Mormon teachings. It was looking at that, they were making claims that could be historically verified or discounted. So I went to that thinking, okay, let's examine them. Let's see how they stack up. So history, if it hadn't been for history, I would probably have still been in that particular group. Also, it's weird, I guess some of you had this experience in different ways, how your own personal history, when you look back on it, weaves through different strands. I can look back to the mid-1970s, before I became a Christian, when I was in England with my parents. I was going to bookshops buying second-hand books, new books, that were about church history. I can remember one of them was a great book called Religion and the Decline of Magic by a guy called Keith Thomas. I bought that in 1975. I only ended up reading it in the last few years. Why would somebody who wasn't even a Christian be buying books as a teenager on church history, you know, when I had no clear inkling at that time that that's something that would be an important part of my life? So I think, you know, often the clues are there. A friend of mine put something on Facebook the other day, and it said something about, you know, forget the past and, you know, live in the present and look to the future. And I had to sort of respond a little bit and say, look, I always have to respond to this forgetting the past thing, because to me, forget the past equals make no sense of the present, equals struggle to cope with the future. Just ask Jason Bourne. You know, so for me, if we're looking at the present and looking to the future, we have to look to the past to get those threads. And sometimes the way those threads come together are quite weird and wonderful. And it's only by pausing to look back that you actually see the different ways in which God may have been moving through your life in the past to bring you to where you are. And also the way in which that might be drawing in the future. The point that I made earlier, which I made in terms of the IVF journey, about some doors are open, some doors are closed and need to be kicked down. I've seen that in a number of ways through my life, and I'm convinced of the truth of that. Of course, discerning which doors need to be kicked down is the next issue. And one of the other things that I'll just leave you with this thought is, I've been struck with the delicate balance between our pursuit of God and God's pursuit of us. So when I look at my story, I can see ways in which, oh yeah, you know, sure, I was pursuing God when I was reading the New Testament, when I was walking around Ireland, you know? Or I've been pursuing God when I've been doing theological study. But when I look back to those events that led up to the garden, that tomb in Jerusalem, when I look at events like that, that were beyond my control, things that just were woven together, I can see God's pursuit of me. And so I just encourage you to reflect perhaps on your own journeys as a closing comment. Look back at where you've been. Look at those threads that have brought you to where you are now. Look at how they might be coming together to point to a direction in the future. Looking at the doors that are open, the doors that are closed, and the doors that need to be kicked down. Which doors might need to be kicked down for you? And to take a moment, as you know, as we begin this new year, to reflect on what are the ways in which not just you've been pursuing God, but to reflect on what are the ways in which God's been pursuing you. Because he doesn't scream that most of the time. Okay, maybe in that garden tomb surrounded by three choirs and flashbulbs, maybe that was a fairly loud scream for me. But most of the time, it's not that loud. Most of the time, it's the subtle ways in which God pursues us. And it takes some time to reflect, to spot them. So my prayer is for you guys that as we start a new year, that it'll be a time of reflection for you, and it'll be an exciting time in your journeys, both as individuals and as a body here. God bless you.